We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. If you ask people here in this country what would make the greatest positive difference in their lives, it's likely that a lot of people will say more money. At the same time, if you look at surveys that have been done over the last few decades, surveys of happiness in this country, you will find that even as per capita income has grown, people's ratings of their happiness have not. So that seems to suggest the question, well, what really makes people happy? This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be trying to look at some recent research on happiness and try to ask the question, well, what do we know about what makes people happy? And then a much larger and perhaps more difficult and maybe more interesting question, should the goal of government be to maximize the happiness of individual citizens? Our guest for the program is Derek Bach. And he is the author of a book that explores this subject. The title of his book is The Politics of Happiness, and the subtitle, What Government Can Learn from the New Research on Well-Being. It's published by the Princeton University Press. Now, just a little bit more about our guest. Derek Bach is the 300th anniversary university research professor at Harvard University, where he is also the president emeritus. He's been a lawyer and also professor of law, dean of the law school. He's written a number of books dealing with issues in higher education, and in his current research, he's particularly interested in the state of higher education. But a different topic for us here this morning, the subject of happiness, well-being, how it is we measure it. And again, as I say, the question being, does government have any sort of responsibility in trying to maximize happiness for individuals? So questions here are certainly welcome. We'd like to know what you think on the subject, and you can participate in the program in a couple of ways. You can call, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call, use that. It's 800-222-9455. You may also email your questions, comments to will-talk, so that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Professor Bach, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, and how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Thanks very much for giving us some of your time. I think, just to start off with, I think that it is true. Certainly here in America, some other places as well, that we measure the well-being of individuals, people that is tend to measure their own well-being, and we measure the well-being of society almost exclusively in economic terms. And what it is you're suggesting is, I think what you're suggesting is we might think about that a little bit differently. And maybe the place that would be interesting to start, as you do in the book, is to talk a little bit about a place where they've actually, as a matter of national policy, have actually said that this kind of well-being, not economic well-being, but this other kind of well-being, is something we're going to really work towards, and that's Bhutan. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Bhutan is a tiny landlocked country sort of wedged between China and India, a very beautiful country. But a remarkable thing happened in the 1970s. The king, who was a very popular king, announced that from henceforward, the chief goal of national policy was going to be not the gross national product, but gross national happiness. And he was very serious about it. He's Western educated, and he got his advisors to work out fairly elaborate measures for seeing how much happiness changed as a result of government policies. And since then, he's sort of gradually moved the country toward a set of objectives that focus on the of course, he is interested in growth because there is a great deal of poverty there. but a very strong focus on education, on better health, on the environment. And the country has made a lot of progress. Interestingly enough, the people did not want democracy because they liked their king. And so you had the unusual situation where the king, against the wishes of his of the people, kind of gently insisted very gradually that they develop a democracy. And so they have. They've had their first elections, and they have an independent court system and so forth. But they've also made a lot of progress in improving the literacy of the people, giving free education through the ninth grade, free health care to everyone, and a lot of environmental measures because they believe that happiness is connected to the beauty of their surroundings. And sure enough, the average happiness in Bhutan has certainly increased according to all the surveys that have been done.
Mm. No other country has done this, has made happiness of its citizens a priority in this way, although it's also the case that in a lot of other places that people in government, social scientists, have thought about this question. They've thought about what it is that makes people happy and whether or not the society should make some sort of commitment to do those things or to try to do those things. Why do you think it is that this is something that not only has captured the interest of social scientists, but also has captured the interest of some people in government?
Well, you're right. There has been, although no country has adopted happiness as its official goal, except for Bhutan, a number of countries have expressed interest in it. They're studying it. There have been several proposals in different countries to include measures of happiness among the official statistics that are put out. So there's certainly a good deal more interest than there was. Part of the reason is it's only recently that researchers have begun to study happiness empirically. I mean, there was very little attention paid before the 1970s, and by now you've had about several thousand articles, empirical studies published about what it is that makes people happy and what it is that makes them unhappy. And they've come up with some very interesting findings because it turns out that people are not very good judges of what will make them happy or what will cause them lasting unhappiness. They tend to focus too much on the immediate sensation of changes in their lives. So they think a new car or a vacation or a promotion is going to make a big difference. But actually, they adapt very quickly to those things so that the happiness is very short-lived. So I think governments are becoming interested just because the researchers are finding things that are somewhat unexpected about what makes people happy. And they're showing that you can't just run opinion polls and answer those questions because people are not very good judges of what makes them happy.
That's an interesting point, I think, because one of the ways that social scientists have tried to get at what makes people happy is simply to ask them. At the same time, though, it, as you say, there's good evidence to show that people are not very good judges of what will make them happy. At least there are two things that seem to be going on. One is that, as you say, maybe people think that having a new car will make them happy, or having a new house will make them happy, or, you know, whatever it is, and that very quickly that initially it may, but very quickly that wears off. There's also an interesting way in which it seems that human beings can actually try to make the best often of a bad situation. And so if there's something in their life that's just not the way that maybe they'd like it to be, that there it is possible for people to say, well, I can deal with this, and this is not the end of life. And if a disability comes along, many people will say, well, you know, I can live with that, or whatever kind of setbacks they have.
That's right. People are very good at adapting, and you can lose an arm or a leg, and before very long, you do adapt, and you may not be quite as happy as you were before, but you recover a great majority of any loss of happiness, and it disappears as you become accustomed to it.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit more about this notion of money and happiness. And of course, the people always will toss off the old saw about how money can't make you happy. But at the same time, it's very difficult to get away from this notion that there is this relationship between your financial wherewithal and whether you're happy. Now, one of the other, though, findings that you point to right here, right in the beginning part of the book, interestingly enough, is that although overall, if you measure it on a per capita basis over the last half century, per capita income has gone up, the average level of happiness in the United States has changed almost not at all.
That's right. There is a good deal of evidence that points that out, but I should say this is one of the questions, bearing in mind that happiness research is really a new venture. It's one of the questions, and a very important question, on which the evidence is really mixed. It isn't that anyone has proved that money doesn't bring happiness. The evidence just seems to cut in both directions, and nobody's quite figured out exactly how you can put it all together into a coherent whole. And, for example, you're quite right, Americans aren't significantly happier today than they were 50 years ago. Also, there's a recent study that shows that that compares the average happiness in all the states of the Union, and strangely enough, you find among the happiest states are relatively poor states like Louisiana and Mississippi, while the richest states like Connecticut, New Jersey, and New York are among the least happy. So that makes it look as though money really doesn't make any difference. On the other hand, we also know, and there's a lot of research that shows, that rich people are, with a lot of exceptions, but on average, rich people are happier than poor people. And rich countries are happier than poor ones. So putting all that together, as I say, it's just very difficult to come out with a clear conclusion either way.
Mm. And certainly we're not saying, you're not saying that if you compare someone who is living in abject poverty, living on the street, doesn't know where the next meal is going to come from, doesn't have their basic needs taken care of, you take somebody like that and compare it with somebody who, you know, may not, we're not talking about Bill Gates, but we're talking about somebody who, whose needs are taken care of. They have housing, they have clothes, they can take care of their children. You know, they're not worried about their survival every minute. Chances are, if you compare those two people, the person whose needs are satisfied, chances are they're going to be happier than the person whose every day is a struggle to survive.
Oh, I think you're quite right. That's very very good to point out that it is quite clear that if you are really very poor, more money will make you more happy. There's not much doubt about that. But when you start comparing the wealthier countries like the United States or Scandinavia or Switzerland, or when you compare populations of people who are all reasonably well off, certainly their basic needs are taken care of, then the impact of becoming still richer, getting still more money, becomes very muddy.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Derek Bach. He is a professor at Harvard University and also served as president of the university from 1971 until 1991. He was the 25th president. He also served again as interim president from 2006 to 2007. He is the author of a number of books. He's particularly interested in higher education. But his new book is about happiness. The title is The Politics of Happiness, What Government Can Learn from the New Research on Well-Being, and it's published by the Princeton University Press, which takes a look at a couple of basic questions, one being what does research, social science research and psychology and economic research tell us about what makes people happy? And then the big question is, if we can know that with some level of confidence, then should government be working to along those lines to maximize people's happiness? Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, having said a couple of things, having said that it's this question, what makes people happy, is maybe not an easy one to answer. And that also having said that, people aren't a very good judge of their own happiness or what will make them happy. So simply asking people, that's kind of questionable what kind of data you're going to get. Having said all that, we do know that there are people who have done research into this area. In fact, we have one here at the University of Illinois who's quite well known. Generally speaking, are there some things that you think that can be said with some fair level of confidence about what it is that makes people happy?
Yes, I think that there are some generalizations. Let me give you some. Among the things that seem to make people happy for an enduring period, and not just for a few minutes, a few days, a few weeks, I would list the following. I think personal relationships have been shown to be very important. Strong and good marriages, friendships, belonging to organizations of all kinds that bring you into contact with other people, those are very important. Another thing that is important is how healthy you think you are. Now, the interesting thing is how healthy you actually are by doctor's tests and things like that has a pretty weak relationship to happiness. But how healthy you think you are has a much stronger relationship. Helping others, people who seem to be involved in community service and acts of kindness to other people seem to be happier as a result. Religion is a source of happiness, partly because being religious usually means belonging to a community of faith, but it's been shown that that's not the only thing. If you have a strong religious faith, that, at least in the United States, seems to be causally related to lasting happiness. And interestingly enough, with all the controversy that's going on now, good government has a lot to do with happiness. A democracy, a government that guarantees freedom, a government that people trust, one that seems to be reasonably effective and efficient. All those things have an impact. In fact, one of the interesting things is if you look at the governments of the countries that are most happy, they're almost all countries that have been democracies for many decades. It's worth working toward good government because it not only produces good things, but it produces a good deal of happiness as well.
Hmm. I know we've talked about this, but I guess I wonder what you make of our given the fact that we have research that shows these kinds of things contribute to happiness, and when you hear that list, you think, well, that all sounds quite reasonable. That we continue though to have this preoccupation with economic well-being as is the chief and sometimes really the only way we measure our happiness and our well-being, both individually and as a society. Why is it that we can't quite seem to get away from that?
Well, I think it just seems to make sense that and the culture reinforces it. We spend about at least 50% or even 100% more on advertising than any other country and per capita. And so you have this continuous barrage about how this product or that prescription medicine or this new car is the key to happiness. And I suppose when you hear enough of that, then you certainly do, watching television during a day or reading the newspaper, you begin to believe it after a while. And it makes a certain plausible sense. If I could buy more of the things that I want, I'm going to be happier, because who is better judged than I about what will make me happy? So I think on the surface it does seem to make some sense, and I can at least understand perfectly well why people would think that.
Mm-hmm. Going back though to this other finding that says people often aren't very good judges of what will make them happy.
Yeah.
And maybe even if also it is the case that one of your avenues, if you're a social scientist, one of the – maybe you'll have some ways to try and get around this. But if one of your avenues is just to ask people, well, that's going to – that should lead you to question what it is that people tell you. When you – again, when you look at these things that research seems to tell us about happiness, can you have some confidence that, in fact, that's correct?
Well, there's been a lot of work done on that because it's such an important and such a natural question to ask. What people have done is to try to say, well, can we see whether people's feelings about how happy they are kind of correlate with some objective evidence? So there have been a lot of studies to see whether people who say they're happy smile more often. Are there things in their behavior that indicate that they really are happier? And most of those results seem to indicate reasonably strongly that there is something to the validity of people's answers about how happy they are. For example, the people who say they are happier tend to live several years longer on average than people who don't feel they're so happy. They commit suicide less often. They're less likely to be depressed. They're less likely to suffer from alcohol or drug abuse. So there's one connection between people's opinions about how happy they are and kind of objective real-world results. There also have been some studies to see whether people who are, say they're happier, whether that corresponds to the views of people who are close to them, who presumably can offer independent judgment. And there is a fairly strong correlation between how happy you think you are and how happy your spouse and your close friends think you are. And finally, there are some tests to see whether people who say they're more happy, whether they do smile more often, whether the part of the brain that is associated with happiness lights up more often. And all of those things do show some correlation between people's perceived happiness and what these physiological tests seem to indicate. So if you put it all together, I would say it isn't airtight, but there is a fairly substantial body of evidence that says that what people think they are about their happiness does actually have some roots in reality.
Yeah. There's also been some kind of interesting work where they have taken people and they've given them some kind of a device, some kind of a little beeper or something that will go off randomly.
Yes.
Throughout the day. And so the assignment is that you give this to some person. The assignment is when this goes off,
yep.
I want to know right then. Don't think about this too much. I want to know right then, what are you doing and
sure.
How would you rate your happiness at that moment?
Yes.
And it is very clear that if you look at some of the activities and the happiness, that working is not the thing that makes people most happy. It's pretty down on the list. But if you look at particularly these things like that do involve being together with other people, all these things that you do that involve these kinds of social connections, and also includes things like praying and exercising. Although those things are pretty high on the list, so that
sure.
that would probably tell you something that these things, this sort of list we had before of what makes people happy, personal relationships, and your perception of your health, and are you doing something for other people, and do you have some kind of religious faith or spiritual component to your life, would sort of suggest that those things probably are on target.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And actually, there are two ways of measuring happiness, because happiness is probably not just a unitary concept. I mean, it's partly a matter of just how much pleasure or displeasure you're feeling at a given moment, but it's also a somewhat more reflective thing about how do you feel about your life and the way you're, by and large, the way you're living. And researchers use both methods, and the The one you mentioned is one that helped to win the Nobel Prize for Daniel Kahneman at Princeton, which is to call people up and say, what are you doing right now and how happy do you feel? And the other method is to call and not ask about how they feel at this very moment, but to say, how satisfied are you with your life? And you put those two things together and you've got a kind of reasonable picture of people's overall well-being.
We're at our midpoint of this hour of Focus. So let me just very quickly again introduce our guest, Derek Bach. He is the 300th anniversary university research professor at Harvard. He is also president emeritus of the university. He's been a lawyer, professor of law, dean of the law school, and as I said, has been president of Harvard. He's written several books on higher education, and in his research interest, he's certainly interested in the state of higher education. We're talking here this morning about the subject of his most recent book, though, which is about happiness. And the title of his book is The Politics of Happiness, What Government Can Learn from the New Research on Well-Being. Princeton University Press is the publisher. Questions, welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, something else that researchers have done is they have tried to go around the world and ask people in different places, different countries, about their happiness, and then try to come up with a ranking that would tell you something about where in the world, in what places, people are the most happy. What do you find when you try to rank countries according to how satisfied people they are with their lives?
Well, I think they tend to come up with the same group of countries, although the rankings sometimes change a little bit. The United States is certainly among the happiest countries of the world, but it's not among the very happiest. It's not in the top 10 countries, for example. It usually comes in somewhere around 13th, 15th, 16th, something like that. The happiest countries tend to be small countries with stable democracies that seem to be fairly efficiently run. The Switzerland would be an example, the Netherlands, the Scandinavian countries. There's another group of countries that show up not always in the top, not in the top 10, with one exception that I'll come to, but they seem to be a lot happier than you would think by just looking at the statistics, and that is the countries of Latin America. So Costa Rica does often appear in the top 10. Of course, Costa Rica is unusual. It has no army. It has a very high literacy rate. It has a lower infant mortality rate than the United States. So it's an exceptional country, and people seem to be happier as a result. But mostly it's these countries in Western Europe, Canada, North America, that have been stable democracies for a long time and seem to do a good job of taking care of their citizens.
Mm-hmm. That gets to the one item on the list of happiness that seems not really about the individual in it so much. I mean, it's the other things we talked about. Well, what makes people happy? Personal relationships, good marriages, friendships, people's ideas, their perception of how healthy they are, whether they're involved in doing something in their community, helping others, do they have faith? You know, all those things are really kind of internal to the individual. The one thing that stands out is perceptions of government. Do people think that their country is well governed? And this would seem to be, you know, of all those things, if you're going to ask, well, why is it that people in Denmark are more satisfied with their lives than people in the United States, and up these the top countries, so many of them are Scandinavian. You have to ask, well, is really the big thing there government and its social policies?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the the very happiest countries are ones in which there's a very high level of trust and confidence in the government. And they're not just democracies, they're not just countries that respect freedom. Those are very important. But what really pushes you up in the upper echelon seems to be that the people have a lot of confidence in the government. And, of course, in the United States, there is really quite low confidence in government. And I'm sure that's one of the factors that tends to pull our results down.
Well, let's take a caller here. We have somebody who is standing by in Atlanta, Illinois, so they'll be first on our toll-free line. This is line four. Hello.
Good morning. Interesting conversation. I have a trite hobby that involves some creativity, and I get tremendous pleasure of that. I don't smile and laugh while I'm doing it. As a matter of fact, it's fairly tedious, so I'm concentrating. But I've always thought that maybe happiness, a lowest common denominator, might be creativity. It seems that people that are creative are kind of addicted to being creative. And although I'm not creative to any extent, it is when I seem to be, quite happy when I'm doing that. And I wonder, you might have covered this before I had trouble dialing, and I might have missed it, but my question is, what does creativity lead to as far as happiness?
Well, I'd answer that in two ways. First of all, people who say they are happy tend to be somewhat more creative than people who don't, which is an interesting thing. The second thing I think we do know is that one of the things that does produce happiness is when you get so immersed in an activity that you kind of lose yourself. You don't really think about what's happening to me, how happy I am, should I be doing something else? You're just fascinated by what you're doing, and you're totally absorbed in it. That feeling seems to be one that people look back on as being particularly happy. So to the extent that creative people are people who are able to lose themselves in the sheer fascination of trying to solve an interesting problem or how to paint a beautiful picture, those people do seem, as a result, not all the time necessarily, but while they're engaged in the creative act, that is a happy period, precisely because they're not concentrating on themselves. They're concentrating on the thing that interests them and brings out the creative talents that they have.
Well, that's an interesting comment, and I think that leads me to another thing that might create happiness is reading, which you kind of offhandedly alluded to in that that little comment before. So I'm going to hang up and listen, and reading might bring out some of the same things that creativity does as far as happiness. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's continue, and we'll go next to a caller here on our line number two, and this is someone who is in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Mentioning Scandinavian countries as being the most happiest is kind of interesting, and I guess a couple of the reasons is that these are the countries that have among the highest taxation in the world, from what I understand, and they also are countries that have very little belief in God. I believe Sweden is like 80% atheist. So these are sort of two things that typically in the U.S., we'd be reluctant to embrace, and yet it seems to work for Scandinavia. So I don't know if you'd want to comment on that, but then a question about Scandinavia. It can be kind of tricky to use correlations among countries to say something about people. So, yes, Scandinavia may have less belief in God than the U.S., and they would be happier. But that doesn't mean necessarily that people at the individual level will behave in that way. So my question is, has there already been any studies in places like Scandinavia with a low belief in God to see if the variation in belief in those countries themselves is somewhat related to happiness?
Well, if I could just stick to the question you gave on religion, because it is an interesting point that perhaps makes it a little bit more precise what I said before. Religion and religious faith make a difference to happiness in the United States. It's much less clear that religion and religious faith are significant elements of happiness in other countries. And as you point out, apparently religious faith does not have the same effect in Sweden as it does in the United States.
Does that get at your question?
You know, studies have actually been looked at in Sweden itself at the variation. I mean, are people there who are religious happier than those in Sweden who are not? I mean, that's sort of the question there too.
I think the what the research seems to show is that religion does not seem to make a significant difference to people's happiness in at least. I don't think all the countries have been tested, but at least in several European countries, it doesn't seem to have the effect that it does in the United States.
And then, on the other hand, people are not necessarily unhappy when they're paying 40-50% more on their taxes, as long as they're getting, maybe you can tell us what in return.
Well, I suppose you'd have to be a Swede to answer that, but one thing you do have in the Scandinavian countries is a high degree of security. Now, for example, in the United States, if you don't have health insurance, and we know that a great many people who don't have health insurance, they don't go to the doctor when they think they should because they can't afford it, and they don't take the medications that they're supposed to because they can't afford it. And they don't know what will happen if their children get sick, that the kind of anxiety that produces probably, I would think, would eat away at the happiness that you feel. The other thing about some of these countries, quite apart from taxation, is that one thing we do know, surprisingly, that causes long-term unhappiness is losing your job. If you get laid off, that has a very strong effect, and it lasts a long time. And the loss of money is the minor part of it. It's the loss of self-respect, the feeling that you're going to be a failure in the eyes of your family and your neighbors and your friends. So that even when you get another job back at the same rate of pay, the bad effects of being laid off continue. I mean, you get better, but you're still not back where you were before. Now, one thing you can say about the Scandinavian countries is that they have rather low levels of unemployment, and they put a lot of money into retraining and various forms of work to keep people either training for a better job or employed in something. And that may well have an effect on their happiness.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller. We just have about 10, 12 minutes left in this hour of Focus, and I have someone else I want to get in here and maybe get onto some other issues as well. And just let me also introduce again our guest. We're talking with Derek Bach. He is the 300th anniversary research professor at Harvard University. He also served from 1971 until 1991 as Harvard's 25th president. His most recent book is The Politics of Happiness, What Government Can Learn from the New Research on Well-Being, published by the Princeton University Press. And we have another caller that we would like to bring into the conversation in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Thank you, and thank you again for being on the program. I have reviewed the happiness research, and there's a couple things related to some other work, and a couple things puzzles me, and I have questions around that. The first is that the studies have been done, and the cross-cultural studies or cross-country studies have been done. As far as I know, I have not found any that didn't deal with aggregate data. So you're mm-hmm. dealing with all income levels when you
sure.
look at that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other finding is that, by and large, with some exceptions, there seems to be a clear regression line between income and happiness up to a certain income level till basic needs are met, and then it tends to flatten out, and that's pretty well been found in different countries.
Well, that's a matter of dispute, actually. The most recent data from the World Survey that the Gallup organization put together was interpreted by some very good researchers to indicate that happiness kept on rising as countries got richer. So as you point out, there's evidence on the other side. But one of the unsolved questions is precisely whether happiness does continue beyond a certain level of income as incomes rise.
Right. It does rise as countries become richer, but that's aggregate data, again, as opposed to within those countries.
Yeah.
And it's pretty consistent, I think, within the countries that the regression line is pretty clear up to getting basic needs met, and then thereafter it's unclear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in any case, that leads to my question we do know that higher income is correlated highly with better health, but I don't know of any research. My own hunch is that you get a pretty flat line after basic needs are met if you control for health. In other words, that the poorest people are at least happy up to getting basic needs met, and then from then on you have if you control for health. But I haven't found anyone who's really studied that, and I've looked and looked for that. I just wondered if you would either comment on that as a proposition, or if you know of anyone who actually has done anything in that area.
I think maybe we might have lost our connection with the guest. Hold on there. We'll see if that's the case. We may need to put the call back through. We do have about 6-7 minutes left here in this hour of focus with Derek Bach, so we want to make sure we wouldn't get back. He is the author of a new book, and again, if you're interested in reading the subject, book is The Politics of Happiness, What Government Can Learn from the New Research on Well-Being, and it is published by the Princeton University Press, just out now. And again, questions are welcome. We'll try to accommodate as many people as we can, and the time, however, is growing short. Again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And, of course, we do have that possibility for email at will-talk@illinois.edu. And I think maybe we've gotten our guest back on the phone. Professor Bach? Yes, I think Professor Bach? Yeah, I'm sorry. Something happened there. We lost you. I don't know what.
Yeah, my phone just went dead.
Okay. Well, hopefully won't have any problems here for the next few minutes. It was something that I really want to make sure that we do, because we've spent a lot of time here talking about happiness, is at least look at the other question here, the other question that you're interested in. And that is, if we can say something that we feel fairly confident about happiness, then should government work along those lines to try to maximize happiness of its citizens?
Yes, I think there are three good reasons why the government should take the research seriously. One is that happiness, after all, is the thing, according to opinion surveys, that people most value. And in a democracy, governments should certainly be interested in promoting the thing that its own citizens believe to be most important in their lives. The second thing is that, as I've indicated before, if people can be happier, it is very helpful to them on objective grounds. They live longer, they're less likely to be depressed or to rely on alcohol or drugs. But the other very interesting thing is that the things that make people happy, by and large, tend to be good for society. Stronger marriages, more participation and involvement in government and in helping your community and helping other people, so that what you get if government does try to promote happiness is they're responding to what matters most to their constituents. They're putting their constituents objectively in a better place, and they are contributing to a stronger, healthier society. So it seems to me that this is definitely a win-win proposition, and one the government should take seriously.
Now, I'm sure that this is something that people will argue about, and that they would want to say, some people will want to say something like, well, if we have good reason to believe that those things that make people happy, they're really very much internal to individuals. They're about the way those people live their lives. And rather than this being something that government can do, that it's really, you know, whether an individual is happy or not, it's really up to him or her. And that what government can best do is be lightly involved in people's lives, get out of the way, and allow people to work toward their own happiness.
Well, certainly there's a lot that goes into happiness that government can't do much about. I said before, one of the most important ingredients of happiness are the personal relations you have, and government can't create friendships for you or create happier marriages. To that extent, I would agree. But there are a lot of things government can do that do affect happiness. I mean, it's significant that the least happy countries in the world are all countries that have very bad governments, and the happiest countries in the world all have governments that people have confidence in. So governments can affect unemployment, which is a significant cause of unhappiness. They can affect the amount of worry and anxiety people have, which is another cause of unhappiness. They can certainly try to keep people from being abjectly poor, which by any calculation contributes to unhappiness. So I guess if I had to generalize, I can say governments can do a lot that will relieve many of the sources of unhappiness, and that's certainly worth doing. The last thing
I'm afraid that we lost the guest again. I have this feeling that that was going to happen. We're coming down to a couple of minutes left. Please bear with us. We'll again see if we can get Dr. Bach back on the program here. If you're interested, again, his book is The Politics of Happiness, What Government Can Learn from the New Research on Well-Being. It is published by the Princeton University Press. It's just now recently come out. We have gotten a number of calls. We've gotten some emails, and we'll see if we can try to get in the comments here. But again, if people would like to participate here, 333-9455 is for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email. You can always email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe I'll just take a moment here as we're getting the caller back up. One of the people who are listening wrote in with this comment, and actually it was a quotation from Roger Ebert, the film critic, which I like very much, and so I'll take the opportunity to read it. Apparently Roger said this. He wrote, "I believe that if, at the end of it all, according to our abilities, we've done something to make others a little happier and something to make ourselves a little happier, that's about the best we can do. To make others less happy is a crime. To make ourselves unhappy is where all crime starts. We must try to contribute joy to the world, and that's true no matter what our problems, our health, our circumstances, we must try." He goes on to write, "I didn't always know this, and I'm happy I lived long enough to find out." That's from Roger Ebert, One Thought About Happiness. We're down here for the next to about a minute or so left. I don't know if we're going to be able to get the guest back on or not. I think we pretty much did a pretty good job of covering the topic. I think the issue maybe was something that was going on the telephone on his end. So we're at that point. I suppose what we could do is we could maybe take one more caller here, and we could see what's on the minds of people who are listening in. So let us do that. How about that? We'll go to Urbana, I think, number two, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier that people were not happy when they were at work. But I was wondering if those are people working for someone else or if they were working maybe at their own jobs or working at a favorite hobby or something like that. Does his study make the difference in terms of employment? You know, what type of work makes people unhappy or happy?
Well, that's I'm sure that that's a good question. And what I was just quoting and what he quotes in the book is some of the research that has been done by people who are interested in this question of happiness. And simply what they seem to be doing was they were asking people, what are you doing right now? And how happy do you feel? And according to some of the data that's here in the book, the thing that's down on the bottom of the list is working. But I take your point. It's that that all is going to depend on what it is you're doing, you know, what your level of satisfaction on the job is. Is it something that engages you creatively, engages your brain?
Right.
You know, I think that it made me think of particularly there's a psychologist who I've talked with a couple of times, a man named Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who coined this term flow for the state you're in if you're doing something that's really challenging and that it's challenging enough so that it is a challenge, but you're up to the challenge. And it's that state of mind you get into, and it could be doing something artistic. It could be doing something athletic. You know, it could be climbing a mountain. It could be doing sculpture. It could be doing math problems. You know, whatever it is, it's that thing that engages your talents, your ability, your interests to the point where it's almost like time stops.
Yeah.
And if you're lucky enough to have a job that can be like that, I would think that might indeed be a source of happiness and satisfaction. And so you would rank that maybe a little bit higher. So I think it probably all depends on what it is you're doing.
That's exactly what I was thinking about. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, we're going to have to wrap up this hour of Focus. I'm sorry we just kind of lost the guest there at the very end, but I'll just mention one more time you'd like to take a look at the book. It's The Politics of Happiness, and the subtitle is What Government Can Learn from the New Research on Well-Being by Derek Bach, and it's published by Princeton University Press.